Hello, everybody, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. My name is Grant Padalko. I'm an editor at rferl.org, our English language website, and I'll be your host this week. In this week's show, our 20th, we kick off a new monthly music segment called Ear to the Ground, hosted by Romanian journalist Lucian Stefanescu.
Today, music from the Balkans with a touch of American swing, but also Balkanic music from the United States. So a little bit of a transatlantic crossover here.
Kenan Aliyev, the director of RFERL's Azerbaijani service, recalls some of his more ridiculous days as a young journalist in Baku, when trips to the state censor were a daily routine.
For example, a couple of times, the articles about dictators like Saddam Hussein or Hitler or Stalin were also censored. And we asked them, why are you censoring? This is not about the president. They told us, no, we know why you're writing this. You're writing about Saddam Hussein, but you're thinking about Haydar Aliyev.
American singer-songwriter Bob Dylan celebrates his 70th birthday this week. And Salome Asatiani, a broadcaster in our Georgian service, examines Dylan's enormous influence on artists across our broadcast region.
I think Dylan's greatest achievement is that he taught musicians how to write lyrics, and he taught the whole world to listen to the lyrics.
But first to the Balkans, and I'm joined in the studio by Nenad Pejic. Nenad is an associate director of broadcasting here at Radio Free Europe, and he's a frequent commentator about developments and issues related to the Balkans for our Balkan service and for rferl.org, our English language website. Nenad, welcome to The Blender.
Good to be here.
So, Nenad, just as we sat down to record this edition of the podcast to talk to you about the Balkans, we get news that Ratko Mladic, the most wanted war crimes fugitive in The Hague, has been arrested. It was announced today in Belgrade. Did you ever think that you would see this day?
No.
Why not?
No, actually, I didn't believe this would ever happen. Simply because I thought, like the Karadzic case, you know, if somebody is hiding in Belgrade, in Serbia, doesn't matter, with a fake identity, fake name, fake ID, fake driver's license, this fake identity could be given to someone only by secret police. There is no way that somebody else can provide this kind of identity. It means the state was behind it. Parts of the state or all of the states, this is a different issue. Secondly, the reason I was thinking that it would never happen, because if they extradite him to The Hague, to the ICTY, they are giving to The Hague very strong evidence from a legal point of view about how Serbian army was heavily involved in the war with Bosnia, and not only Bosnia, of course. So as a consequence, Bosnia, maybe even Croatia, could ask reclaim for money the Serbia is supposed to pay for the war atrocities. So this was my feeling. But obviously I was wrong. The question is why. What happened in the last 10 days, for instance, if you remember, Serge Brammers, the head of ICTY, the top prosecutor of ICTY, came to Belgrade and said in the front of the Serbian leadership, I quote, Mladic is in Serbia. I expect his capture. So he didn't say, I think he is in Serbia, or I hope he's going to be captured. He said, he is in Serbia. I guess this statement was followed by evidence. And suddenly, Serbian authorities, I believe, found themselves in position to have evidences where Mladic is, what street, what house was the name, and they had the choice, well, what were we going to do now? There was no chance anymore to say, well, we'll do our best, etc., etc. So just a day later, President of Serbia, Boris Tadić, said, well, on Mladic arrest, he said, this could even happen tomorrow. So fortunately, I believe they did take a right choice.
And what is Serbia going to get out of this?
A lot. I think Serbia is gaining, first of all, internationally. I think they're going to get EU candidacy pretty soon. I wouldn't be surprised if similar statements, maybe not the strict ones, but kind of statements of great hope or that Serbia is heading toward EU candidacy is coming soon from Brussels. This is the first. Secondly, I think the Serbian position related to the Kosovo, and Kosovo is the biggest priority of Serbian foreign policy. So their attitudes, of course, is going to be now listened to a little bit differently. People are going to be, I mean, politicians, leaders in the world are going to be more receptive to these statements. Tadic even said today at the press conference, he did mention Kosovo, and now he expects Kosovo and others to work on these organ trafficking accusations, etc. And he's right. He now has the right to demand something like this. So position is stronger. And point three, something we all keep forgetting, you know, it's IMF and other financial institutions that will now be more willing to help with the fiscal crisis and any other crisis of financial type that Serbia has. This is on international level. On regional level, I believe their position is also going to be stronger. Now they have right to say to others, look, we did our job. It's your turn now. Don't forget yesterday, day before yesterday, actually, Serbian TV, managing board of Serbian TV, issued a statement asking for apology of the viewers in Serbia and in the region for propaganda they were doing prior to the war and during the war in early 90s. So now Tadic can say, well, guys, well, now it's your turn. And he would be right. He might not get kind of the status of being regional leader, as he keeps saying, but if he continues to go with this process in Serbia further, meaning, okay, who is now responsible that Mladic had a fake identity, or who is responsible for the propaganda war, or who is responsible for the fake extradition requests related to Ganić, General Divjak, etc., then he might even get the leadership in the region. Others are anyway weak. But there is one man, I think, all in the region that now could worry, is the president of Republic Srpska, who positioned himself as a hardliner, not only among the Serbs in Bosnia, but among Serbs in Serbia as well. So he is the one I think need to worry. And finally, domestically, first of all, what he's going to get back support from those members of his own Democratic Party and the voters who voted for him because they were disappointed about him because of the slow path of the reform that Serbia was going to. And among those supporters, there were even those who were cynically calling him Ken. You know, Ken is the guy from Barbie's boyfriend from the kids' toys. And even Berlusconi called him recently George Clooney. So it was really cynical because Tadic has an attractive face. I guess your female listeners are going to agree with me. So this cynicism they will need to take back because he did show a capacity to be a statesman. Secondly, domestically, 2 weeks ago, I believe, it was a poll published in Serbia that 70% of Serbian citizens would not report to the police if they knew where Mladic had been hiding. And I don't really expect these kind of numbers to appear on the streets. I do expect some protests, but not the big ones. Besides, don't forget, Tadic controls media. Actually, his office controls media. And this is almost literally controlled media. So I think he calculated pretty well. And he positioned himself pretty well. And the last point, what he's going to gain domestically, is that parliamentary elections are supposed to take place till the next June 2012. 2 months ago, oppositions called for early elections. And now Tadic might meet their demands because it actually be now in his favor. And this is what are the gains he's gonna have.
Well, Nenad, we'll end it there. Thank you very much for being on The Blender.
You're welcome.
And if you want to read Nenad's commentaries in English, you can find them on referl.org.
You're listening to The Blender, the weekly podcast from RFERL.
Lucian Stefanescu is a Romanian journalist and music lover who's hosting a new segment on The Blender starting this week. We're calling it Ear to the Ground because that pretty much describes Lucian's permanent posture. He's a guy who's on top of the latest music, especially the interesting sounds bubbling up from RFERL's broadcast region, countries whose artists often don't get the wider recognition they deserve. Take it away, Lucian.
Hello there, I am Lucian Ștefănescu. Welcome to the very first edition of Ear to the Ground, a special section of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's podcast, The Blender, a section that deals with music from all over the world. Today, music from the Balkans with a touch of American swing, but also Balkanic music from the United States. So, a little bit of a transatlantic crossover here. Almost 1 week ago, Belgrade-born DJ and producer Marko Milicevic, also known as Gramofonetze, performed at Atelier de Producție, which in English means the production workshop in Bucharest, a former industrial location transformed into a space for experiments in visual arts, musical performances and theatre. Marko is a Serbian producer and DJ, as I said, famous for his electro swing house productions. Personally, I'm not very fond of house music, but when house is mixed with swing, things change a little bit, and probably exactly because of this house and swing mix, Milicevic was voted the best Adria act during the 2010 MTV European Music Awards. Nothing new though, because he just brought to the region a fashion that began to haunt the dance clubs all over the world a few years ago, when swing music was put again to work in order to make people rhythmically move their bodies in dance halls. I spoke to Milicevic before his concert in Bucharest and asked him, what does swing music actually mean to him?
I think that swing music is, from its beginnings, like almost 100 years ago, is something that is like best music that is representing life. And it just makes you move and, you know, makes you move further. And I think through years, music changed a lot of shapes, but swing, in the core of it, it stayed the same. If you check the swing tracks from 1920s, if you see the arrangements of the tracks in 1920s and the arrangement of the new dance tracks, is the same. It came from US, but here in the Balkans we also have our music, Balkan music, which is in a core also, it's swing music. It has this swingy feel.
Your music is not necessarily Balkanic as we know it in former Yugoslavia.
I like new stuff. Foreign music was like interesting to me, but then I realized when I started playing music and everything that like you can incorporate a lot of Balkan beats into, because it's swingy. It has this live feel. But also you can find the same thing in Africa. You can say you can find also some really same, how to say, beat patterns in Asia.
And I'm very happy that you mentioned the Balkan beat. You are from Belgrade.
Yeah, I'm from Belgrade, yeah.
The following in our program will be a band from Bosnia, Dubioza. I don't know if you have heard about
it. Yeah, I'm doing a remix for them. I'm doing a nice Balkan beat swingy remix for them at the moment.
Marko Milicevic, DJ and producer from Belgrade, speaking for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, about Dubioza Collective. Dubioza Collective is a Bosnian band from Zenica, and its music is a mix of various styles, ranging from reggae, dub, and what is now called gypsy rock. They sing about peace, understanding and tolerance, rejecting the nationalism and injustice that resulted in the Yugoslav wars of the early 1990s. The band was founded in 2004, and we are listening now to Balkan Funk, a song from their 2010 album 5-12.
Ja svira, ja moram da plešem. Moj život je blank,
to je Balkan funk.
Katrana i dima, da pluća se lijepe. Ne udišem zrak,
to je Balkan funk.
Volim puno rakije kad sjednem za šank. Beznaj moj tank,
to je Balkan funk.
Sabilam kad sila si mi sela u grad.
I smrdim ko skank,
to je Balkan funk.
Check it out now, funk su obrade, right about now. Funk so brother, check it out now. Funk so brother, right about now.
Balkan Funk by Dubioza Collective. They are going to play next month in Cluj, the capital city of Transylvania, during the 5th edition of the International Romani Festival. We cross the ocean right now to New York, where a very special band is based, Balkan Beatbox. Balkan Beatbox is an Israeli musical group founded by Tamir Muscat, Ori Kaplan and Tomer Yosef. Kaplan and Muscat met in Brooklyn, New York as teenagers. They both grew up with music. Kaplan had been a klezmer clarinetist, while Muscat was a drummer in a punk band. They created a very special sound by fusing the musical styles of Mediterranean and Balkan traditions with hip-hop and dancehall beats. What I personally like about this band is that it is an open multinational collective. As Tamir Muscat said in an interview for Pittsburgh Tribune Review, I quote, "In Sweden we had an Iranian rapper, in France we had a Moroccan Gnawa musician, we have Bulgarian singers sometimes, in front of 6,000 people in Switzerland, we had gypsy dancers from Transylvania," end of quotation. Their 2010 album, Blue Eyed Black Boy, was recorded in different European locations, Ori's adopted city of Vienna, Austria, the Serbian capital of Belgrade, and the band's mutual hometown, Tel Aviv, in Israel. So here's a song from this album, a song called Lijepa Mare. Lijepa Mare from Blue Eyed Black Boy, the 2010 album by Balkan Beatbox. The band is going on tour in the United States in July this year. My name is Lucian Stefanescu. Thank you for being with us. Stay tuned to The Blender at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
Thanks, Lucian. Keep an eye out for the next episode of Ear to the Ground in June on The Blender. Iconic American singer-songwriter Bob Dylan turned 70 on May 24th. His heartfelt songs have been translated into dozens of languages and have inspired poets around the world, changing the global landscape of popular music. In the following story, written by Robert Coulson and narrated by Salome Asatiani, we look at the lasting imprint Dylan has made on artists across RFERL's broadcast area.
Ce-o fac fără să dai nimic în scris? Ce-o fac exact așa cum ți-au promis?
Eu sunt Londin, e Paris.
The music and words of Bob Dylan speak most of the languages of the world. The iconic American singer and songwriter was born on May 24, 1941, in the small town of Duluth, Minnesota. His paternal grandparents fled anti-Jewish pogroms in Odessa in 1905, while his maternal grandparents arrived in the United States from Lithuania. Over the last 5 decades, Dylan has produced nearly 1,000 songs, many of them indispensable additions to the soundtrack of the 20th century. It has been a career of shocking and unpredictable twists and turns, from the anthemic protest songs of the early 1960s to psychedelic rock poetry, to intensely personal and introspective lyrics, to songs that have been shaped by the roots traditions of American country and blues music. And his influence has been truly global. Sviatoslav Vakarchuk is a musician with the Ukrainian rock band Okean Elzy.
I think Dylan's greatest achievement is that he taught musicians how to write lyrics, and he taught the whole world to listen to the lyrics. Before him, the lyrics in popular songs were just a supplement to a nice melody, simply a set of memorable words. After Bob Dylan's appearance, musicians started thinking that it was possible to convey their own thoughts through music and even carry out social experiments by playing guitar or through singing.
Kyrgyz rocker Bakit Kidikbaev, leader of the band Salty Peanuts, agrees.
Bob Dylan changed the nature of rock music. That's a great contribution. While people even in the West in the 1960s accepted rock music as a light pop genre, Bob Dylan started using strong words with strong meanings.
Armenian singer and guitarist Ruben Hakverdian wrote his popular 1960s song My White Dove under the influence of Bob Dylan's classic Blowing in the Wind.
Specifically in writing my song My White Dove, I was influenced by his song. I think that song was about freedom. That song had made such a huge impression on me. I was impressed that freedom is sleeping on the wings of wind and so on. It was under that influence that I wrote that particular song.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Many in the Soviet bloc first heard the music of Bob Dylan through a popular Radio Liberty program called Metronome. It was hosted by jazz musician and music producer Cornel Shiriak. Here is Shiriak on February 8, 1975, introducing Romanians to Dylan's classic album, Blood on the Tracks.
Astăzi, pentru a asculta noul album al lui Bob Dylan.
Today we'll listen to Bob Dylan's new album, an album received with mixed reactions by the critics. Nobody knows if it should be praised or criticized. While Melody Maker and New Musical Express reviewers struggle with this dilemma to criticize or not, a journalist writing for the English magazine Disc begins his article by expressing a truth that must be taken into account when speaking about Blood on the Tracks. Listening to it is like listening to Dylan's music for the first time. Here's Tangled Up in Blue.
Așa este și în bluesul, Tangled Up in Blue.
At the age of 70, Dylan is as active as ever, performing more than 150 concerts a year and still producing albums of powerful, original material. Georgian music producer Gheorghe Asanishvili welcomes the inward direction that Dylan's songwriting has taken in the last decade or so.
I think today we are living in such times that singing about love has itself become kind of a protest act. Things have become so debauched, so much pointless music and poetry and literature are being produced about love, that to write a beautiful love song or a poem is in itself a protest against all this. And I think this is what Bob Dylan is doing at present.
That was Salome Asatiani, a broadcaster in our Georgian service, and a big Dylan fan herself, I happen to know.
З вами Радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда Кушніка.
Айче Радіо Европа. Машал Радіо.
Азатить Радіосе.
Азатицюн ГТМ.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
You know, working at Radio Free Europe is a bit like working at the United Nations, what with those 21 countries and all. And as you can imagine, these experienced journalists from Russia and the rest of the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, just to name a few, have some pretty interesting tales to tell. In This Is My Story, I invite one of my colleagues into the Blender studio, turn on the microphone, and give them one simple command. Tell me a good story. This week, Kenan Aliyev, the director of RFERL's Azerbaijani service, talks about his days as a journalist in Baku in the 1990s, when state-ordered censorship was the rule of the day, and journalists just had to laugh, when they weren't pulling their hair out, that is.
My name is Kenan Aliyev. I am the director of Azerbaijani service of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm in charge of broadcast to Azerbaijan. And my story is about my days of journalism in Azerbaijan and the experience we had when I worked for the local newspaper with government censorship. I used to work for the Azadlik newspaper, which became an opposition newspaper when President Aliyev, Heydar Aliyev, came to power in the middle of 1993, and immediately this censorship basically got stronger and stronger. Government introduced the military censorship, police censorship, and political censorship. But officially, it didn't exist. So did it mean having censorship for the editor and for the newspaper journalists, that every time before the newspaper was published, we had to take the makeshift of the newspaper to the censorship office, and they had to read every article, every item in the draft, and put a stamp. Without that stamp, you couldn't get your newspaper published in the printing house. And that time, it was only one printing house in Azerbaijan, state-owned printing house. So without seeing that stamp, printers wouldn't take your newspaper. And so we had to go through this process almost every day, and because we had a daily newspaper. And when I was on duty, I had to also, with my colleagues, take the makeshift to the censor's office. They were actually very interesting guys. Some of them were former journalists themselves, but now they were censors. So they would read every article, and sometimes they would like the article, for example, but they would cut pieces where they would see any criticism of the president, especially president. You could criticize still some ministers, some officials, but when it came to the specific policies or everything which was about president, it was immediately censored and cut from the makeshift. So then getting the stamps and taking this newspaper to the printing house, so next day we would have the newspaper with white spots. And it was clear that something happened to the newspaper. They realized that these white spots, which are left after newspapers being cut and published, are giving government a bad image. So, for example, OEC officials always would question, okay, you're telling us there is no censorship, but why this newspaper, Azadlik or other independent opposition newspaper, they're published with white spots. You know, there are white spots all over the newspaper, and especially in the articles which are talking about the internal politics. So the censor told us, you cannot have now white spots, you have to fill them with some kind of material. We said, okay. So we start putting cartoons there. We had a brilliant cartoonist. His name was Rashid Sharif. And these cartoons were reflecting that actually this white spot was covered by, for example, cartoon where you had the tongue being cut by scissors or pen which is surrounded by barbed wire. And so it was giving immediately a message to reader that this newspaper was, of course, censored, or this article was censored. So censors told us, no, you cannot do that too. You have to put there something else. So and we said, okay. So we went back to the office and discussed this and said, okay, we will put the articles from the Constitution of Azerbaijan, which claims that censorship is not allowed. It's illegal in Azerbaijan. So censors realized that, you know, they have another challenge. But, you know, some of them were reluctant to censor the constitution of Azerbaijan, which was approved by the same president. But at the end of the day, they even censored the articles from the constitution about basic freedoms, which showed that this is not about constitution. It's not about respecting the rights. It was just about controlling the information in Azerbaijan. Or, for example, a couple of times, the articles about dictators like Saddam Hussein or Hitler or Stalin were also censored. And we asked them, why are you censoring? This is not about the president. It's not about the leadership of Azerbaijan. They told us, no, we know why you're writing this. You're writing about Saddam Hussein, but you're thinking about Heydar Aliyev. So this kind of incidents we had all the time. Once, for example, we decided to interview the main censor. His name was Jahangir Ildirimzadeh. This was an old guy from the old Glavlit. So in the Soviet times, he was also responsible for the censorship of the literature, of the newspapers and stuff like that. It was a long shot, but, you know, we said, we ask him. And he agreed to be interviewed, which was very surprising for us. So we asked him, why do we have censorship? And what is your role here? And when it's going to end? And he, you know, kind of, yes, he admitted that, yes, we have this process because we have a war and there is, you know, instability in the country and we need to have the censorship and stuff like that. So we were very surprised and, you know, happy that finally government official who is responsible for the censorship and the control of the media agreed to be go on the record. So next day, we bring the makeshift of the newspaper, including his interview, to be censored by the same people. And first thing this gentleman does, he cuts his own newspaper from the makeshift. So basically, he found his own thoughts dangerous to the society. Censorship was abolished in 1998 before the presidential elections. Officially, it was abolished, but I can say that things didn't get better after the abolishment, since government start using courts and trials and pressure against the journalists. You know, we had several journalists in jail. Many newspapers were fined for thousands of dollars of fine. And one journalist is still in jail. And journalists still experimenting with self-censorship because now they're facing different kind of threat.
That was Kenan Aliyev, director of RFERL's Azerbaijani service. That's all for this week. If you've got a question or a comment about the blender, good or bad, we can take it. We'd certainly like to hear from you. Write to podcast@rferl.org or leave a comment on the blender blog at rferl.org. I'm Grant Padelko. Thanks for spending a bit of your day with us. We leave you this week with, you guessed it, a bit more Dylan, one of my favorite songs, called One More Cup of Coffee. You know what? That guy could sing.
Your breath is sweet with your eyes. I like two jewels in the sky. Your back is straight. Your hair is smooth on the pillow where you lie. But I don't sense affection. No gratitude or love. Your loyalty is not to me.